Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Jason Kelly. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Bloomberg Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio.
We want to move to our own expert here. Brian Granulati is the Chief Executive Officer of Atlantic Health System, joining us on the phone from Morristown, New Jersey. Obviously, a state like here in New York that has been hit very hard. New Jersey's death rate actually eclipsing, the daily death rate eclipsing New York's, I believe, for the first time today. So clearly a lot going on, and a lot going on as we think about what happens next, even in terms of reopening the economy. Brian, really good to have you with Carol and myself.
Thank you.
So give us a sense of what you are seeing on the front lines there. What is it like, and what's maybe new and different today or this week versus in the preceding weeks?
Sure. You know, you had mentioned the differences between New York and New Jersey, and I got to tell you that you got to follow the transit lines because what happened in New York followed the transit down into New Jersey, and we have been really overwhelmed, as you described here, in New Jersey, particularly in northern New Jersey. So today at our command center call, we had 544 patients with COVID in our hospitals, and about 35% of those patients are still on ventilators. Mm. So we have a very sick patient population. But that's down from our peak, which was on April 9th, where we actually had 834 patients. So we're down about 35%, but it's still an enormous number of patients.
You know, as we've gone through this process, Brian, I mean, what have we learned about being prepared next time, you know, and what we need to do in terms of really shoring up our health system and access for everyone?
You know, there's a famous statement, it's about the economy. Well, it's about the testing. Mm. I mean, our major lesson here is testing was a problem at the beginning. Testing continues to be a problem today. And if we don't get this testing right as we go into recovery, we're going to have a rebound effect, and we're going to be back in the soup again. And we have to be very, very careful about that. The second thing that we've learned is that just-in-time delivery doesn't work in a pandemic. Mm-hmm. And our supply chain is really broken right now. We went through periods of enormous panic, making sure that we had the right kind of protective equipment for our team members to keep them healthy and safe. Ventilators were a big issue over a period of time. I can tell you just a weekend we spent scanning the nation for ventilators and being able to have many of our colleagues in different parts of the country support those. And it's the same thing with medications, particularly those medications that support people on ventilators. So what we've learned is we've really got to fix this supply chain. We've got to have more control over it because, you know, COVID is not going to go away until we have a vaccine. And that could be a year and a half or 2 years away. So we have just threaded the needle here in New Jersey. The governor has been a fantastic ally and advocate for us, particularly with the federal government and the stockpiles. But we've learned a lot, and we got to make sure that we continue to use the tools that we have, the predominant one being social distancing right now.
So, Brian, I want to talk a little bit more about testing, if we could, because I feel like we want to go a level down and understand both testing for the disease and also the serological, the antibody testing. What do we know now, and what is important for our listeners to know in terms of what they should be doing, what they should expect, especially, you know, in and around your hospital system over the coming weeks?
So the frustration that we've had with the diagnostic test, in other words, do you have COVID or not, is we needed to get that right at the point of care so there wouldn't be delays in providing a definitive diagnosis. Because many patients come into the healthcare system and they don't need to be hospitalized, about 80%. The 20%, so when they go back, they need to know if they have a diagnosis or not so they know whether to self-quarantine. That diagnosis wasn't coming back for 3 or 4 days, and that was a big problem. The 20% of the patients that go into the hospital, we have to treat everybody as COVID positive until we have a definitive diagnosis. And in that instance, about 45% of the patients that would go into the hospital and be tested would be under, we wouldn't have a test result on them. So we were burning through all that scarce protective equipment because we had to treat everybody the same. So again, we have to have a point of care test on that. And then going forward, as we open up healthcare and start doing some of the care that's been pent up, and you've seen articles written recently about that, where people are just staying home instead of engaging in the health system, which they need to do, we're going to need to provide that test at that preoperative time or pre-procedure time in order to make sure that we know those patients do not have COVID. So the diagnostic tests are going to have to be at the spot you're doing the care, and they need to be able to be determined right away.
And when you say point of care, I just want to make sure that I understand. When you say point of care, that could also include a pharmacy or someplace like that, right? Or am I misunderstanding?
Well, if you're coming in for a diagnostic test or if you're coming in for a surgery, it would be in a facility like that where you do your preoperative testing. The second piece that you talked about, antibody testing, that's going to be important as it provides some clarification on whether or not you have had the disease previously. Now, over the last week, you've seen two things happen in that space which are concerning. One is that we are getting an incredible variation of results on the different tests that are being done, the types of tests that are being done. And it's really caused some pause and some concern, but clearly we've got to run that down. Because what we don't want to do is give somebody an impression that they have built up the immunities. And then the second piece that's been of concern was the feedback we got from the World Health Organization over the weekend that perhaps having those antibodies does not necessarily protect you again from getting this virus. I think more work needs to be done in that space because the consequence of thinking you're bulletproof on this and you're not going to get it again is a problem.
So, okay, I don't want to get all dystopian on everybody, but Brian, describe to me then what our world is like going forward. Is it we all just have to get used to a lot more testing, wearing masks, and potentially, I mean, you oversee a massive hospital system, 7 hospitals in New Jersey, I think roughly 17,000 members, almost 5,000 physicians, 11 counties, you know, 5 million people, you know, have access to your system. Is it a case that, you know, how we go about getting procedures, it's going to be very different and we have to just get used to it. That's going to become the new norm. And we also will have health facilities that are separated into virus, where people have the virus, and those places that do not.
Yeah. The first thing I want to say is that our hospitals are safe. I would argue our hospitals are very safe compared to some of the other things we engage in our communities as we seek our activities of daily living. So we're safe to begin with. But as we think about needing to continue to care for this virus, we will, as our volumes go down in our hospitals, these patients will be contained in very specific areas where they won't be interacting with other patients. The team members that will care for them will care for those patients and not care for other patients during their shifts. And we need to make sure that we have safe pathways through our organizations so that we don't have people intersecting inadvertently. And all those steps are being put in place literally as we speak. We also have, when we do turn a unit over and have it become a non-COVID unit, we do a terminal cleaning in there and make sure that everything is safe. So patients shouldn't be safe or shouldn't be scared and they are safe. The thing that we need to think about, though, to your question, is this will be a period of wearing masks. This will be a period of maintaining social distance. This will be a period where you can't bring your entire family in on your office visit. Those are the kinds of things that we're doing. We're going to continue to really use telehealth in a big way, but we're also in the process of opening our offices. You mentioned we have a lot of physician practices, and we're doing that also.
And so I guess just to drill down at a further level, how long does the sort of era of social distance and masking and all of that last in your estimation, Brian? Is it till we have a vaccine, or what do we need to see in order for, you know, life to even optically look something like close to normal?
Yeah. You know, in a perfect world, that's the answer. It's a vaccine. Mm. But the reality is that that's going to take a while. So we've got to continue to pursue a couple of things. One is we've got to pursue effective treatments for this disease, because that will go a long way in itself to taking the scare out of this. The second thing that we've got to work on is just continuing to educate the public about the importance of washing your hands and using a lot of common sense, you know, the kinds of things that you learned when you were a kid, and make sure that we're adhering to those things. But we also are going to be in a position where our lives are going to be a lot different. You know, I think about restaurants, you know, paper disposable menus. Instead of something that seats 100, it'll seat 50. And those all have huge impacts on those various industries. But we will be in a different place. But the key thing, again, just to go back to it, is we've got to be able to have the testing available so that when we do get an outbreak, we are on that and doing the tracing we need to do. And that is kind of the blocking and tackling of a public health system.
Brian, just got about 30 seconds here. Are you bracing your team and preparing your team, though, potentially for another second wave here? And just got to be quick.
Yes, we are. We are absolutely preparing for that wave, and we will pray that it doesn't happen. But we will be there, as we always are, to serve our communities safely, and that's really what we're all about.
Thank you so much. Yeah. We really appreciate it. Thank you so much. Brian Granulati, a really thoughtful conversation, a realistic conversation about where we are on the medical front as it comes to the health system. Carol, he is the CEO of Atlantic Health System, joining us on the phone from Morristown in your great state of New Jersey.
In my great state of New Jersey, and just understanding a little bit more of what life is like on the other side. And I think, you know, the more information we know, the more secure we will feel about kind of re-entering. And so it was really great to get some time with him. All right, coming up, we're going to check in on an interesting story that's in Bloomberg Businessweek magazine this week, and it all has to do with that active-passive management kind of added again.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow. Did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann. Let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
I gotta say, I'm just not sure how this is gonna go today. It's just one of those days. It's one of those Lemon It's Tuesday.
Totally.
And we're going with it as much as we can. Joel Weber is joining us, as he does most days at this time. He, of course, is the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, as is Justina Lee, markets and quant reporter, quants reporter for Bloomberg, joining us on the phone from London. And Joel, I feel like this is almost like a little throwback to your time as editor of Bloomberg Markets. Like I'm digging this. I'm digging it. Tell us about this story.
So there was a kind of a Bloomberg News call, regular call, about a week ago, and Justina kind of piped in with this idea that she was kind of noodling, and as she was describing it, I was just like, "Wow, this sounds so perfect for Bloomberg Markets. I want it for Bloomberg, and I want it for Bloomberg Business Week." And it's really about small versus big companies, which is one that I think, you know, we're going to obviously spend a couple minutes talking about here. It's also going to be, I think, a theme that will resonate for the coming year for investors, particular, if not years. And it really, what really caught my ear, though, was the word quants. So just, you know, you want to figure out how to make sense of this for us?
Yeah, sure. Because essentially what quantitative investors do is that, you know, they don't rely on human judgment. They use their computer models to try to find a couple of trading signals that they then apply across thousands of securities. And so I initially got this idea talking to a quant fund, and what they were telling me is that the dominance of all these mega cap stocks, you know, like Netflix or Facebook, was really not good for their kind of strategies, because they're essentially underweight mega caps, given that they're so diversified. And I thought that was a really interesting kind of intersection of this nerdy realm of quants, and also a phenomenon that I'm sure all of us are noticing in the market.
So what does it tell us about kind of what they're seeing? And because it's interesting, you know, Justina, because we talk so much about active versus passive, right? And we know the passive play has been, you know, done so well for so long, coming off of the financial crisis and until recently. Kind of what did you take away from kind of doing this story and about that argument and that debate that's been going on?
Right. I mean, essentially, one trend that has been making it even harder for the active stock pickers is that, you know, since the crisis, we have seen big companies get even bigger. Now, a lot of people think this is, you know, a structural trend in the sense that a lot of these tech companies are taking advantage of essentially a winner-takes-all economy. Because as an active stock picker, you want to be different from the benchmark, so you want to feel like you have your own original ideas. So a lot of the time, you're naturally underweight large caps. But, you know, when the big gets bigger, that's not an advantage for active stock pickers. And we've kind of seen that, you know, ripple through the asset management industry with a lot of acquisitions and with even more people turning to ETFs each year.
So Justina, what about right of late? Just, you know, the past few months have been so crazy. And, you know, in theory, I guess maybe, you know, a quantitative approach could take out the emotional effect. What's been happening with quants of late?
Right. I mean, obviously, I'm generalizing a little, but this year hasn't been great for quants either. And part of the reason is that, you know, they tend to have more exposure to small caps, which have been underperforming. They also have more exposure to value stocks, typically, which, as we know, have also suffered even more than growth stocks. And so it hasn't been a great year for quants either, but they're always saying, you know, in every market, when valuations are so stretched between the winners and losers, there could be a snapback. And it's interesting because I think these past couple of days, we've seen a little bit of that, like small caps coming back a little. It's definitely far too early to say this is a trend.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting too. I mean, I guess, guys, to think about who the winners and losers are, at least so far in this. And I feel like we're going to get a little bit of a picture of this week, Carol, when all the tech companies mm-hmm. are starting to perform. And Joel, it does take me back to some extent. And this company is mentioned in the lead of Justina's story. It takes me back to Zoom, which was the subject of a great cover story in the magazine a couple of weeks ago. I mean, sort of discerning the winners and losers here, even from beyond the quant perspective, but just from a stock and a business perspective, it feels even trickier right now.
Yeah, and especially as you know, if we think about the market share that sort of a situation like this pandemic kind of creates for like an Amazon, where you can just see like how a big company could really, really thrive here while so many small ones get hurt. But now that said, like, you know, I recorded a podcast earlier with Eric Balchunas, and one of the things that he was kind of thinking about on the ETF side is just like, you know, small companies have been so beaten down, and he just kind of has a theory that like you can only beat these things down so far. Like over the long term, we might actually see some of these the smaller companies and even the small company value ones really outperform over the next 3 to 5 years. So from a long term play, there might be something to that. Justina, like any reporting on that end from you?
Right, exactly. I mean, for my story, I spoke to the head of quantitative strategies and Northern Trust Asset. His name is Michael Hunstead. And what he told me is that the size factor, which is, you know, betting on small caps, it's not dead. It's just that it's an incredibly long cycle. I think it's around 8 years in his research, meaning that you could be underperforming for 8 years. But if you stick it out over the long term, it actually still works out. Of course, the problem for most people, especially if you're a fund manager that needs to get paid, is that most people don't have that kind of patience. But if you do, you know, the academic research indicates that exposure to small caps should still outperform over the long run.
I got to say, this is the kind of story that just, you know, Joel, it just makes the market even more interesting as we try to figure out kind of what happens next.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, to me, it's like that great buy and hold lesson. Like if you mm-hmm. if you can seriously like buy and hold it, right, it might be worth thinking about.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. It's a great story on the Bloomberg, one of the most read. Not surprisingly, it's in the upcoming edition of Bloomberg Business Week. So find it online or pick up the magazine when it's out later this week. Justina Lee joining us from London. Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, joining us from Brooklyn.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive home.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
Keep driving, you crazy.
Just drive, baby.
Drive me crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
Take a break. We can reach our destination.
This
is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
It is time for the Drive to the Close. Just got about 15 minutes left in today's trading day. Carol Masser along with Jason Kelly. Back with us is Alan Zaffron. He is founding partner and co-CEO at IEQ Capital, joining us on the phone from Foster City, California. Alan, good to have you here with us. How's it all going?
Well, I tell you what, it's beautiful weather out here. Home sheltering isn't bad when you've got 80-degree weather and sunshine, so it isn't all bad in California.
Are people still sheltering, though, with that kind of weather?
They are, and if you're listening to Mayor London Breed in San Francisco and you're in the six counties around surrounding San Francisco, you're sheltering at least through the end of May. Mm-hmm. So California has a tighter lockdown possibly than other parts of the country, and we'll see in the long run whether that was prudent or not, both from a health as well as an economic perspective. But the rules are the rules, and that's the way we are in California and Northern California currently.
And so what do you make of it? I mean, as a longtime businessman, you know, someone who's watching both the markets, but obviously has watched the rise of Silicon Valley and just the economic boom that you've seen there in Northern California. Obviously, it's a balance, Alan, but I wonder what you make of it.
I make of it, it's fraught with challenges. Clearly, it's a negative economically. Clearly, it's a positive from a healthcare perspective. The reality is we probably were not built to handle a massive amount of emergency cases heading into hospitals. We would have been overwhelmed. It's easier to look in retrospect and think we should have acted sooner. We didn't. Yeah. In the absence of doing that, we had to take some action steps. The question will obviously be, was the cure worse than the disease? Not entirely sure. It's very clear that there's been significant economic damage that's going to last years, not weeks, not months. Years. And so that's the sad part of this is you're going to see a tremendous amount of economic damage. And the worst part of this,
right.
Jason and Carol, the inequity between the wealthy and those that don't have has only been exacerbated by this crisis.
Let's get back to Alan Zaffron, founding partner, co-CEO over at IEQ Capital, on the phone from Foster City, California. Alan, what do you think so far of, we could debate a lot about how long it took and, you know, whether the, you know, the shutdown will hurt us more in the long term. There's lots to be said, lots of criticism about what we did wrong, and there are things certainly that folks have done right. But I do wonder about the aid that's coming, because that's really important, and that's the kind of forward-looking story about how we get through this and how do we look on the other side of the virus. So far, so good?
But if you think of it this way, aid can only do so much. It's almost like there's four things that have to get done because you really have a medical crisis. So you can lower rates to zero like the Fed did, and that helps. That doesn't solve a virus problem. You can have the federal government throw money to individuals who are unemployed. That doesn't stop a virus problem. So ultimately, it's helpful, fills the hole from some of the unemployment gaps and lack of economic activity when 54% of small businesses are shut down in America. But the reality is until we get a solution for the problem, you're still going to end up in a world of volatility and uncertainty. And until someone has a clear-cut vaccine with it being widely distributable, it's a fool's errand to think that the volatility has suddenly gone away. Don't be fooled by the last week. We're not out of the water yet. It's still going to be tough.
Right. And that's clearly true, Alan, for anyone who's looking at this with a clear eye. And yet, I take a look at I want to bring you one headline related to your state. California reporting 1,576 new COVID cases, 54 deaths in the last 24 hours. I believe that's a tick up maybe from yesterday. So we'll bring you more details on that. That, of course, coming from California Governor Gavin Newsom. He's giving his daily update over the last hour or so. What I was going to say, Alan, is in terms of valuations, and we've been talking about this over the last couple of days, especially because it's such a big tech week, you've got the NASDAQ that I'm looking at my Bloomberg terminal right now, is down less than 4% for the entire year. So things aren't necessarily cheap right now.
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head. I can't tell you how many questions the last week I've had about, I can't believe how come this market's going up. The indexes are hiding the weakness. The NASDAQ is reasonably flat for the year. The S&P is down, you know, like 10% for the year, but small caps are down 25%.
Yeah.
It's because defense is what used to be high beta. It's no longer beta. Large cap growth, businesses that aren't as reliant on basic economic activity, you don't need people visiting you. They're low contact sports, so to speak. Those are the businesses that have been working in this economy and probably will continue to in a low growth environment. So the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ are, in a way, hiding the broader Main Street economic weakness, and that is where the money is rotating. And until there's greater semblance of a reflationary economy, which could be several years away, large cap, U.S.-centric large cap growth seems to be the place where there's more steady growth, and all things equal, ironically, it's a safer place to put your equity capital.
Right, and the companies that we can probably bank on to get through all of this, ultimately on the other side of it. Are you putting, would you suggest, Alan, that still it's a time to kind of pick up some names, certainly in the equity universe? There are some opportunities out there, or do you feel like those easy gains, the bounces off the low, that's already been done?
Yeah, I think the train's left the station on the easy gains. It always makes sense if you're a long-term investor to be dollar-cost averaging. However, it's a world of low growth. You want to stick with franchises, strong balance sheets, and the ability to grow earnings regardless of a very slow economic environment. So don't get caught in a value trap. Just because there's a high dividend doesn't mean it's going to stay at a high dividend, nor does it mean that business is going to be able to generate the cash flows to pay that dividend. Focus on quality, quality, quality right now. Make sure you know the franchises and sectors you're buying into. There's a reason healthcare and tech are the best performing sectors here, because that's where the secular growth is now and going forward.
I feel like that's, I was just going to say, I feel like that's going to be our new world order.
Healthcare and tech?
Yeah.
Yeah, secular growth. So, Alan, talk to us about real estate. I feel like this is going to be one of the big questions that we are talking about for some time to come, not just from an investment perspective, but from the perspective of how do we consume real estate? How do we use it both residentially and commercially? We had Kent Swigg on our program last week. He obviously has invested heavily, especially on the coast in San Francisco near you and in New York City here near us. We also have these big questions around, are big companies going to take less real estate, more real estate? What does social distancing look like? What does the new workplace look like? And I do wonder, especially given your history of advising a number of wealthy families over the years, real estate has always been a pretty comfortable place for folks, right?
Yeah, it really has, because it's got a very tax-efficient mechanism to deliver income. And I think it's very clear there have been some secular changes. And the secular changes are, first and foremost, there is going to be a shift in work behavior going forward. It's clear not everybody's going to jump back to the office as frequently. On the one hand, I kind of like that because there'll be less traffic driving to and from the office. On the other hand, if I'm an owner of an office building, I think my buyers now, my renters, are going to have more buying power. I think there's going to be less demand for office. So there's definitely going to be some valuation discount probably, other than an exceptionally high-quality office in major metropolitan cities. Secondarily, I would argue that industrial properties, core industrial properties, have actually gone up in value. The notion of delivering more goods and services to more consumers going forward, if you're a warehouse provider for a Target, Walmart, Amazon, it's going to be a good thing. So there's winners and losers. I think the place that's really complicated, not retail, it's pretty clear that it's an over-retailed environment. It'll have to refigure it out, but it's apartments, which has traditionally been a very safe environment. You know, if we're in a world where renters are given a free pass to pay rent, possibly for very good reason, I don't know if that makes the landlords feel very good, and I don't know who's culpable on the back end. And so there is going to be, at least in the short run, some discount to valuations on basic conventional apartment buildings, because what was once perceived to be an exceptionally low-risk income stream, is arguably a little more risk. It depends on what kind of apartment property and what location.
All right. We're going to leave it there. Great to catch up with you. Thanks for being patient with us as we jumped around. We really appreciate it. Alan Zaffron, founding partner, co-CEO of IEQ Capital, on the phone from Northern California.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to our radio show every weekday at 2 p.m. Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.